Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and our guest today is Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. That means it's time for Q&A with Layla, which for many of you has become a favorite theme here on Intelligent Medicine. Each week, we gather up questions from you. You can send us your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we will endeavor to answer them on the air. Keep in mind that we can't answer all your questions. We get a very high volume of questions. Some of the questions are not suitable for airing, but if we select your question, we will answer it on the air and do our best to give you a comprehensive discussion. So welcome to the program, Layla.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you.
So you've got a bunch of questions there. So why don't you hit us with your best shots.
Okay, this comes actually from Sue. She's wondering what you think about oral chelation and if there's a good oral chelation product that you would recommend. And this is actually coming off, I believe, an article you wrote called Can Oral Chelation Therapy Be Trusted?
Yes. And so, okay, well, you know, basically I'm saying that oral chelation is kind of a scam. But when we have to really distinguish between chelation therapy for cardiovascular disease, which is something that's actually been demonstrated to be helpful. I recently wrote a big article for a professional journal just general medicine, which you can find at drhoffman.com. We've linked to that article. And it's a long, comprehensive article on chelation therapy and a recent trial that was done by the National Institutes of Health called the TAC trial. And actually, to the surprise of many health professionals, it turned out positive. Chelation therapy was beneficial. So a lot of cardiologists are shaking their head, well, what's wrong with that study? That can't be right. It's kind of a double standard because there's a lot of negative studies about vitamins, and they go, of course, that's got to be right, but the study which shows that chelation therapy is beneficial, that can't be right. But this is, you know, let's distinguish. This is chelation therapy for cardiovascular disease.
Is this IV chelation?
Yes, exactly. Let's distinguish.
Not oral. Okay.
Intravenous chelation. It must be done by a health professional who's certified and does it in a careful very comprehensive way. It requires training. Not all doctors do this. You can't just show up at a doctor's office and say, chelate me, because many doctors have not received proper training. We, however, offer chelation therapy. I've been doing it for, well, pretty near 30 years. I was actually president of the American College for Advancement in Medicine, which is the major chelating organization of physicians in the country. And so, okay, so that's intravenous chelation. Why don't you describe it? You know what it's like. What does it entail?
You're basically hooked up to an IV for 2 to 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
To chelate.
Or more. Or some, we do it very
or
slowly
more.
And carefully.
Some people do take a little longer.
Yeah.
And many people tolerate it very, very well. We've got some good patients undergoing chelation here.
Yes. And, you know, we do it for circulatory problems. We do it for mm-hmm. patients who've had heart attacks, patients who've had bypass or stents, or patients who are just concerned about their cardiovascular risk. They've been told that they have some plaque, that they're not yet ready for a procedure, but, you know, that may be something that they may be looking forward to or not looking forward to, and they're trying to prevent problems using chelation. So chelation offers a good alternative for them. So that what they've done
when
is...
When would you use IV therapy? Would you use IV chelation for heavy metal toxicity?
Well, right. So let's distinguish. There's chelation for cardiovascular prevention, and that I think only works IV. And then there's chelation for heavy metal exposure, and that all of us have been exposed to too many heavy metals, lead, mercury, cadmium, arsenic, and so on.
AC/DC.
Yeah, so, right, exactly. Pearl Jam, you name
right.
it. Right. So, you know, some of my favorite heavy metal groups, and I've listened to a lot of heavy metal, and it hasn't created any problems for me whatsoever, except that I'm partially deaf. No, but we're talking about Let's get serious now. I know you're a rock guitarist, and I'm serious, folks. Layla is a very accomplished musician. She plays the guitar. These heavy metals can accumulate in our bodies and cause all kinds of problems. They damage the brain, they damage the blood vessels, they damage all the organs. So you can actually use various types of oral chelation products for the heavy metals. It's just that they're now, because of the success of intravenous chelation, you know, it's kind of like those male enhancement products. They say, well, you know, Viagra works, and well, if you don't want to take Viagra, you can just buy our product, and, you know, and it'll improve your sexual performance. Well, most products like that are a hype. Same thing with oral chelation products. They will not clean out your arteries or blast the calcium plaque out of your arteries. Chelation therapy does that much more effectively when it's given intravenously. So, you know, I'm not sure what she's requesting. Does she want to get rid of heavy metals? Does she want to get improvement in circulation?
She was just referring to that article, Can Oral Chelation Therapy Be Trusted? So whatever that you're referring to there.
Yeah.
But we do like to use oral chelation for heavy metal toxicity.
Yes.
And we do very, very well with that.
Yeah, and so the things that can be used, there's a prescription medication called Captomer, sometimes referred to as DMSA, dimethyl succinic acid, which is a chelating agent that you can take orally. In fact, it's actually prescribed to kids who have too high levels of lead or mercury if they have been chewing on pain or if they, you know, swallow the contents of an old thermometer. Thermometers these days aren't made with mercury anymore because we know that mercury is very toxic.
Yeah.
So oral chelation that way does work to reduce levels of heavy metals, but also there's some natural products we use. What are some of those?
We like MetalloClear.
Yes.
And this is without a prescription. It's something we have in our dispensary. MetalloClear does very, very well. I actually have one anecdote of a patient, a new patient of ours, who in the past was shown to have high levels of mercury and lead, and after about a year of MetalloClear, those levels have actually come down significantly. So I was surprised and delighted that an oral chelation product that you don't necessarily need a prescription for can be that powerful.
By the way, I think we sell that on drhoffman.com, but that product is only available from physicians. It's not available in the health food stores. So it's a kind of a physician strength, professional quality product. Like many of the products at drhoffman.com, it's only available through physicians' offices, and you can't just go to a regular health food store or a chain store and purchase that. Also, some natural things you can use. You can use cilantro. Cilantro and garlic seem to have some benefits. N-acetylcysteine or NAC seems to have some chelating benefits.
The precursor to glutathione, which is a wonderful thing. Getting our vitamin D levels up to where they should be.
Yes.
Also ensures our production of glutathione, which is a very potent detoxifier. So that's also important to have. And, you know, everybody who walks in here, we're always looking at their vitamin D.
Indeed.
And it's important.
So those are some of the ways. Now, here you will find over-the-counter oral chelation products that contain EDTA. Now, EDTA is what we put in the IVs, and it works in the IVs, but I really don't think that it works orally, and most experts agree that just taking it orally, you know, all it might do is it might grab onto some of the minerals in your intestinal tract and pull those out. That's not necessarily good. You need to get the EDTA into your blood vessels and to your organs intravenously for it to work to pull out heavy metals. That's the way chelation works. It grabs onto heavy metals, pulls them out of the body harmlessly. So these oral chelation products with a little bit of EDTA, by the way, if you look at many products with preservatives in them, you know, like cereals, things that are designed for a long shelf life, they've got EDTA in them.
Yes.
And the EDTA is used, I mean, so you're getting, in effect, EDTA orally. You know, that would mean that if you eat products that have a lot of preservatives in them, you'll chelate your body and you'll clean out your arteries, you know, by eating, you know, a preservative-laden processed food like a children's breakfast cereal that's preserved with EDTA. That doesn't mean you're going to help your arteries.
Right. That's interesting. And none of the other preservatives like the BHA, BHT is good for us either, those carcinogens.
I don't want to belabor this question, but there are things that can be given to people who have arterial blockage, but you know, you can't really equate them with oral chelation. They're going to be beneficial, like things like chiolic aged garlic extract and resveratrol. The resveratrol product we used is called Longevinex. Vitamin K is helpful. You know, all these things, or fish oil, of course, all these things combat atherosclerosis, and they're part of a, I guess that's a form of oral chelation, you know, to clean out your arteries using supplements. But we cannot put it on the same plane as intravenous chelation, which is much more effective.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And most of all, important for anybody undergoing IV chelation to clean up their diet, because you don't want to redeposit plaque by then going out and having
yes.
pizza and french fries or something.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we have you at the Hoffman Center, because I could very easily order intravenous chelation for all the patients who come here and maybe give them a list of vitamins to take, but they wouldn't do half as good if they didn't get very strict diet parameters and a very specific diet program from you. Which is actually it's the heavy lifting part, because, you know, it's sort of a passive thing to take a bunch of vitamins every morning and to, you know, show up, stick out your arm and get a needle stuck into it and get intravenous chelation. But the really heavy lifting part, the tough part, is to properly modify your diet and, of course, include an exercise program, which
yeah.
you also encourage patients to do when they see you.
And, you know, what that's about, it's a change in behavior. It's not a change in behavior to swallow a handful of supplements, like you say, or come in for a blood test or sit around for an IV, but this is it's a complete change in behavior.
Right. It's
lifestyle.
It's about lifestyle. It's not just about medical interventions like take a pill or take an IV, although those can be helpful. All right. I think we've really hammered that question to death. So let's move on to the next question on your list.
Okay. Actually, I have one for you here from Mike. Mike says, "Hey, Doc, I'm heading into my first triathlon season,
wow.
and I was wondering what you use for fuel before and during your race, and
okay.
also for recovery after."
Okay, that's a great question.
Yeah.
And I got to say, you know what's really interesting is that the more I do this kind of stuff, the less I rely on gimmicks for performance. So I will go out and exercise. Like this morning, for example, I took a swim. You know, not a particularly long swim. It was just like a 45-minute swim in the pool because it was snowing outside. So I decided to jump in the pool. Not an outdoor pool.
It's 45 minutes is not a particularly long swim?
I'm a tough guy, but,
okay.
the water in the Northeast.
I'm afraid to ask you, what's a long swim?
A long swim could be, you know, maybe an hour and 15 minutes or so. I can't.
Wow.
Actually, the limiting factor for me is the chlorine. But, you know, what I often do is I'll just, you know, get up early and jump in the water and swim without even having any pre-fuel. Because actually, I think that there are some advantages to training on an empty stomach. Even after you've, you know, been sleeping and you've been fasting, you can actually improve your muscles' ability to store glycogen and go longer periods of time with a little bit of fuel deprivation if you train on an empty stomach. Some people can't do that, but I think after a while you acquire that ability. So I'll take a run or I'll take a swim. If I'm going more than 25 miles on a bike, I might have something. I might have a little bit of fuel, like something that goes down easy like a banana. You have to be wary of having too much protein or fat in a mm-hmm. pre-meal, in a pre-exercise meal, because the fat slows.
It's heavy in your stomach, sure.
It's heavy. It actually slows peristalsis. It has a long gastric emptying time. So that stuff sticks in your craw. I've made that mistake before some races. I thought, oh, my God, this is a really long race. You know, I'm going to be exercising for 3+ hours, so I'm going to have, big, heavy meal with fat, protein, and carbohydrates mixed together. And that's just not a great thing to do because your GI tract is going to rebel.
Right. Well, would you even recommend that anybody eat prior to a swim?
Swim
in particular.
It depends. I mean, I discussed this in a recent article about, you know, should you have breakfast? For some people, it's important. But actually, studies show that you do best if you emphasize the recovery. And the recovery means that you should eat fairly soon after exercising, within a half an hour, because your muscles will need to be repleted. Your glycogen needs to go back because you might feel shaky. And also, because you're having sort of a training effect, your muscles are stressed and strained, you need some protein and amino acids to help with recovery. And fat is not bad either as a fuel, so I would include fat. For
do you like whey protein for recovery?
Absolutely. Sometimes if I don't have time to have a meal, I'll have whey protein. I'll put in a couple of scoops of whey protein with a little bit of diluted tart cherry juice, which is great for muscle recovery. Mm-hmm. Tart cherry juice actually has anti-inflammatory properties. It has to be not cherry and it has to be unsweetened, but it's kind of tart. And you can get that at a health food store and add that to the protein powder. Put in some ice to cool it down in a high-powered blender. Add some maybe flaxseed. Add a couple of tablespoons of coconut oil for it's a very healthy fat. It also makes it a very nice flavor and consistency. Maybe throw in a half of an avocado. If you want, you can add some probiotics. You can add a little bit of, let's see, what else might be good? Maybe some
little fruit?
Some fresh fruit, some fresh mm-hmm. frozen mm-hmm. fruit would be great, some berries or something like that. Maybe half a banana, and whatever additional ingredients. Some people like creatine for training. I'm not sure that makes you faster for long-distance events. It might be good for strength training. It seems to help build muscle and may improve strength for, bodybuilding and strength training. I don't really find it makes you go faster. I will say this. I did experiment once with beet juice before races. And, having a fresh beet juice seems to raise your nitric oxide, which actually helps to dilate your blood vessels. And some studies have shown that cyclists have better endurance when they take a nice glass of fresh beet juice before a race. But be careful because it's strong and it can actually give you some GI distress. I mean, you can actually, your stomach can be tied up in knots if you're not careful with that. But that's actually been shown to be plausible. There are actually some products that offer beet crystals that may be equivalent to the fresh beet juice. But I think the fresh beet juice is probably better in terms of the nitric oxide generating potential. I'm not too much. There's so many things in health food stores. The sports category is huge because people really want to enhance their performance edge.
Yeah,
I think it's a bit of a placebo.
What do you think of a product like Muscle Milk?
Well, Muscle Milk, I think, has got some potential, but,
I don't like the amount of sugar that's in there.
Yeah, it's got a great name, mm-hmm. but what's your analysis of it? I'm not that familiar with it.
It's got too much sugar in it. I've had too many patients come in and show it to me, and I'm not that fond of the ingredients. I'm much more for a whey protein type of smoothie or something like that, or mm-hmm. just go eat a meal.
Right.
And especially, why do I say whey protein? Because of the branched chain amino acids, which are very good to rebuild muscle and everything. So that's always a good idea.
Also,
I'm always wary of things that are too high in junky sugar. All that junky sugar will also suppress any human growth hormone that would be activated by all that wonderful training.
Yes, exactly.
That's really the other thing.
That's a good point. So, other things that can be helpful, there's a book called The Paleo Diet for Athletes. And what it emphasizes is that we really don't need to carbo load even if we're doing very, very intense endurance exercise, because one thing that really gives you performance edge is if you stay lean, even if you keep a few pounds off. Because you see the people who win these races, they look like gazelles. They're amazingly, thin and fit. I mean, I can't hold a candle to them. If you're carbo loading all the time, as if you're a car needing fuel, you may seem like you're giving yourself a power boost, but actually you just may be keeping excess body fat on, and that's a detriment to performance. So get the book. It's called The Paleo Diet for Athletes by Lauren Cordain, and it's co-written with Joel Friel, who's one of the top exercise physiologists in the country. He actually has written some very, very important books about anaerobic threshold for training and how he's an interval training guy, really a guru to a lot of people in the exercise world. And they co-wrote a book called The Paleo Diet for Athletes. It's excellent. But, they emphasize that you can't do a race just based on, you can't just survive on, know, turkey breast and
no,
water.
No, no,
you know, you
no.
do need some carbohydrates sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, during a race, I'll actually take a little bit of, you know, I don't like Gatorade, but on my
yeah.
bike, you know, especially towards the end of the race, I like to have something that provides me, frankly, with some amino acids and sugars. But there's some formulas that are cleaner. I don't like all the dyes, colorings, artificial flavors.
You don't drink the blue one, right?
Right, the blue, like the neon blue Gatorade or the neon green Gatorade. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
The kids love to guzzle that stuff, but God knows what you're putting in your body. And so that's something if you're, for me, I mean, if I'm going less than a couple hours, I really don't bother with that kind of stuff. I like to just drink water and rehydrate. But you do need electrolytes if you're sweating. And
yeah.
some of these, you can get formulas from, you know, bike stores and a lot of the sports outlets that are cleaner versions of Gatorade. And sometimes they're in a powder form that you reconstitute with water. And, I mean, if you're going to do it like an Ironman triathlon, that's really a whole science. It's truly a science of nutrition because that's where you hit the wall again and again and again. You literally have to eat during that event. It may take a good performance in a Ironman triathlon is like 8-9 hours. So
yeah,
that involves
yeah.
really, you know, eating on the bike, basically, because you can't really eat while you're swimming.
You can't eat while you run, yeah.
You can't eat while you swim, and you can't eat while you run, although you can, you know, grab a bottle of something from a spectator, you know, who's strategically placed along the sidelines to replete you. And sometimes on the race course, they'll have, you know, some Gatorade, which I guess is acceptable in a pinch. You know, I think people exaggerate the importance of sports nutrition for the short stuff that people do, like a 5K race or like a, mm-hmm. you know, like a, mm-hmm. you know, like a 25 mile bike ride. I don't think you should go overboard, in my
yeah.
opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
What else
do you
got?
Do you have any questions?
Do I have any questions? Let me
yeah.
see. Do I have any questions? I do have a question, but I have to open it up here on my computer.
Oh, okay. I've got a question then.
Sure. Yeah.
I've got a question. Hi,
yeah.
Dr. Hoffman. Hope you are well.
Yeah.
I hear a lot of talk about peanuts having high content of mold.
Right.
What about peanut oil? Would the oil still have mold issues? I would like to use it on salads and to cook with. Your thoughts. Thanks. I'd really like to answer this.
Go ahead.
Yes, peanuts do tend to get very moldy, and therefore they're sprayed with a lot of fungicide.
Mm-hmm.
So for everybody out there who loves peanut butter and peanut butter and peanut butter and don't eat any other nut like macadamia or almond butter or cashew butter or some other thing, there might be quite a bit of exposure to the fungicides. And there's a byproduct. There's aflatoxin.
Right.
Which happens.
Very, very serious, dangerous toxin. And
yes,
it actually
yes.
causes a lot of liver cancer in Africa
mm-hmm.
because there they don't have that processing. And they subsist on peanuts, and there are actually a lot of people who develop very serious health problems, including liver cancer, from mm-hmm. tainted peanuts with aflatoxins.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very scary stuff.
But not here, but not here.
No, but not here so much, right.
The problem is they use so many fungicides that you're getting some of that bad stuff in your system.
Exactly.
What about organic peanut butter? They must do something to suppress the fungus. But
I imagine they're doing maybe more natural antifungals or something.
Right.
Just like in organic farming, they're going to use not man-made chemical pesticides, but natural
okay.
things, whatever they may be.
Okay.
So I imagine organic is going to be better. But this question about peanut oil... You don't want to put peanut oil on your salad. Peanut oil is still fairly high in omega-6 fats, polyunsaturates, which can be somewhat pro-inflammatory. I mean, there are worse oils, and actually I'm going to be writing about this in our next newsletter about these various vegetable oils. Peanut oil does have a lot of polyunsaturates, not as much as, say, soybean oil or safflower or sunflower oil, but it's not the best oil to use on your salad. I would use a good quality first cold press extra virgin olive oil or some amount of flax oil. Flaxseed oil is also very nice on a salad. And to cook with the oils, you want to be careful there too, because you want to go with the more saturated fats like coconut, but I'll be getting more into that in the newsletter. So peanuts, yes, be careful. Try to get them organic. You could use a little peanut oil in your cooking, I suppose. Don't go too far, but certainly I wouldn't use it on a salad. What do you say, Dr. Hoffman?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I never use peanut oil on a salad. I use peanut oil sometimes for flavoring like a wok sautéed dish. I actually like sometimes a peanut oil with a little bit of dark sesame oil mixed in, you know, to, you know, last night I made something really nice, which is a Chinese cabbage. I actually posted a picture of that recipe at it's on my Pinterest page, but it may also now be on drhoffman.com. It's wok sautéed bok choy with, you know, you chop like three bok choy and you chop some scallions and you get some shiitake mushrooms and chop those up and you get about a teaspoon of freshly chopped ginger. And then you wok sauté that all together in a in dark sesame oil. You can add a little peanut oil if you want, and it has a nice flavor. And then, so a lot of people have problems with soy sauce, and I don't do well with soy sauce because it's a highly fermented thing. It gets me all messed up.
You think it's the wheat?
It could be the wheat, but it's, you know, even just using wheat free doesn't really help. It might be that it's a fermented product. It's just not great. It's fermented with a mold. So what I use instead is I use Chinese fish sauce, which is, which is kind of, it's like a concentrated, it's a little salty, it has a nice flavor, and, or Thai fish sauce, not Chinese. But don't get anything Chinese these days. I'm not that happy with it. But use Thai fish sauce, as an alternative to soy sauce on your, you know, want to impart a Chinese flavor to your dishes.
And wok cooking is wonderful where the oils, because you're using them for such a short period of time. I mean, it's not a deep fat fry. It's not a shallow fry like making fried chicken, southern fried chicken or anything like that. But when we do these quick sautés in a wok, that's actually more appropriate.
Right. And it's also a good way if you're going to prepare like a meat dish, you can put in, you know, you use the meat sparingly for flavoring. It's not like having a 22-ounce sirloin steak. You know, you use like strips of beef or pork or chicken or fish in with a lot of vegetables, and it's a way to get you and your family and your kids to eat their vegetables because it's the vegetables taste delicious when they're flavored that way. It's not just like, here's your steamed broccoli, you know.
That's boring, sure.
It can be boring, but I mean, I love it. I'm used to it. I have an educated palate, I guess, and so I'm you know, I'm fine with it. But, you know, inducing people to have more vegetables is important. So wok sautéing is a good way to go. So that was from a question on peanuts. We kind of went far afield on that. All right. Let me see if I've got – I have a question. Let me see. Okay, this one, you know, I don't know if we're familiar with this product. It says, Dear Dr. Hoffman, this one's from Mike. I'd like to know what you think of Quest protein bars.
Oh, yes.
They attracted me because they are low-carb, gluten-free, have no added sugar, and have a minimal amount of ingredients. They have about 20 grams of protein, about 17 to 19 grams of fiber, depending on the flavor. I have to say that they're satiating. I'm inclined to think that all this is too good to be true. And when I checked your website, I noticed that you don't sell them. But we do sell paleo bars, right?
Yes, we sell paleo bars. Yes.
But tell us,
they're sweetened with sugar alcohols.
Yeah.
Which is fine, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, I got to tell you, I'm not the biggest fan of bars.
And Me either.
So why don't you give us a little dissertation on bars? I mean, bars are great in a pinch. And occasionally, like, I'm stuck, you know. Like, there's a great thing, like, if you're on a plane, you're traveling, you know, stick a couple of bars in your bag because it's preferable to the kind of junk that you might be tempted to consume if you just are starving and you have, like, a blood sugar attack.
That's true.
But
first of all, some of the danger, well, not real danger, but some of the problems with these bars, this Quest bar in particular, it's actually made with a protein blend of whey protein isolate, but also milk protein isolate. And I wonder, you know, for those with a dairy allergy, this might be problematic. The second problem I see with this bar is it's got isomaltooligosaccharides, which is a prebiotic fiber, but, you know, it's also a FODMAP,
right?
Meaning this particular prebiotic fiber, along with something like inulin, which is another prebiotic fiber, is not great for those with GI issues like irritable bowel syndrome.
Right.
So we'd have to wonder there. Now, what this bar is sweetened with is something called Lohan Go, which is actually monk fruit sugar.
Okay.
But it's also sweetened with sucralose, which back in the day, you know, when I was with Dr. Atkins, sucralose was like the magic bullet. Everybody can have sucralose.
Right.
But guess what?
Right.
Not everybody can have sucralose, and it may be problematic.
Right.
It has been shown to cause some blood sugar irregularity, and, you know, that's another thing.
I see. There's
a pinch.
Yeah.
In a pinch, it's great to have in your purse and your briefcase, but I wouldn't be reliant on these bars.
Right, and I see it has erythritol in there, which is a sugar alcohol. Well, the problem
it is a sugar alcohol, yes.
Yeah, where the sugar alcohols are virtually non-caloric, like xylitol and sorbitol, but they do tend to, if people have irritable bowel with a tendency towards urgency, they do have a laxative effect. I mean, I guess if you're constipated, that's... But they if you go to the website, they do show... an attractive picture of a girl who has what is apparently the latest craze, which is a thigh gap. She has a thigh gap, which is, you know, you can see the space between her between her inner thighs, which means that she's like super slim. But that's actually Dr. Oz just did a special on the perils of the thigh gap fad, which is that girls are trying to thin down so that they have a thigh gap. Apparently, you know, that's a little bit of a stretch.
That could be very, very, especially for hip and thigh girls.
Yeah.
Okay. We'd have to be careful if they're more gynoid, where they, you know, gain weight in their hips and thighs. It's also the last place they lose it, so
right.
They may have to go too far.
Yeah.
Before that thigh gap actually happens.
So, you know, as they say in England, you know, mind the gap. I would say mind the thigh gap because, you know, if you're aspiring towards a thigh gap, you may cause yourself a serious case of malnutrition.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see what else we have on our menu. You can look at yours as well.
Yeah. I actually have a question, Dr.
Go ahead.
Hoffman,
go.
For you.
Yeah.
What do you suggest for a cure for H. pylori?
Hmm.
I also suffer from Lyme disease.
No,
antibiotic treatment for H. pylori was not successful. Thank you, Janet in Connecticut.
Okay. Mastic gum can be helpful for H.
Yeah.
pylori. Also, there's some studies that show that cranberry can be helpful. Some studies suggest that peppermint has benefits. You know, the problem is that a lot of these medications that are now used for H. pylori, things like Prevpac, the H. pylori is becoming immune to these powerful antibiotic combinations. And so we'll use natural agents sometimes. I think EGCG from green tea has also been shown to suppress H. pylori, and possibly you could get some additional suppression from things like oregacillin, which is a potent concentrate of oregano.
Yeah.
It's antimicrobial. There are a variety of ways to approach this, but I got to say that we're undergoing in medicine this fad. It's like a jihad against H. pylori. Everybody who is diagnosed with having H. pylori is treated very aggressively to eradicate it, and that's a mistake because getting rid of H. pylori creates other problems. You get when you get rid of it with antibiotics. That is, you get more serious problems downstream because H. pylori usually is responsible for ulcers. And so downstream, you might develop irritable bowel after successful treatment for H. pylori, but also upstream because H. pylori may be responsible for ulcers and gastritis in the stomach, but its presence actually helps to protect against esophageal problems. So I think
Wow.
we've taken a big wrong turn in medicine by aggressively treating H. pylori.
Is that why antibiotic treatment for a lot of people causes them GERD?
Absolutely.
By getting rid of the H. pylori?
Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, look, there's a reason that, you know, maybe 40 to 60% of the world population has H. pylori. It's not necessarily a pathogen. For some people, it's a helpful commensal that, you know, helps to regulate the environment of the stomach. and does not cause problems. We're not sure why in some people it creates difficulties, more for people in the West, but for people in the third world, it may be a helpful command. Sort of lots of people in the United States. I guess the big concern is that they think H. pylori may slightly increase one's chances of developing gastric cancer. Uh-huh. But that's, relatively uncommon.
But is it because it causes ulcer, or is it the existence of the bacteria itself?
Does it cause the ulcer?
Yeah. Is the ulcer itself the risk factor for gastric cancer, or is it the bacteria itself that's the risk factor for?
That's not clear. It's not clear, but you're right. I mean, it may just be a bystander, and the problem is not the H. pylori; it's the ulcer itself. But its presence is associated with a higher risk of gastric cancer, which is, of course, a dread form of cancer. And that's why, look, it's always this way in medicine. If there's nothing you can do about something, they don't place a lot of importance on it. But once they develop a drug, the approach is find a drug to kill a bug. And you're going to see a great deal of commercial impetus to hype H. pylori as a potential problem. I mean, 20 years ago, they laughed at Barry Marshall, who was an Australian doctor who claimed that you could catch an ulcer, that there was a bacterial or an infectious cause of ulcers. And his colleagues literally laughed him off the stage when he made that assertion. So finally, one day, he came up to the stage and he said, "You see this test tube? This test tube contains concentrated H. pylori. I am ulcer-free at this time. I'm going to do a demonstration." And then to the astonishment and gasps of the audience, he drank down this bug-filled test tube that was full of H. pylori. He promptly came down with an ulcer, was treated with antibiotics, cured himself of the ulcer, and ultimately became a candidate for the Nobel Prize in Medicine. And
wow.
Then after that, they were off to the races developing all kinds of drugs to suppress it. But, I think in natural medicine, we can't just say, okay, well, we don't want to use an antibiotic. We're going to now use natural things to suppress it. The question is not how to suppress it. The question is whether to suppress it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some situations where we don't want to do that. All right. So, by the way, you mentioned our newsletter. Why don't you fill our listeners in on how they can subscribe? By the way, we had an enormous uptick in our newsletter subscriptions.
I think it's because of the new website. Yeah.
I think it's because of the new web, because there's a place on the website where you click on the website and you can get a pop-up box that enables you to put in your email so that you can be a regular recipient of the newsletter. And we work hard and long on the newsletter, try and make it relevant to your concerns every week with new, fresh content. So if you want to get on board with that, go to drhoffman.com and click on the newsletter. Or alternatively, you want to go to drhoffman.com. There's another workaround, which is radioprogram@aol.com. Just request the newsletter and we'll send it out to you. And
also send us any questions at radioprogram@aol.com for the podcast as well as the newsletter.
Right. There's this new thing where, I am, going to answer some of the questions, on the air that people send to us at radioprogram@aol.com. We actually want your phone number if you just want us to answer your questions like we're doing here, without you participating and, you're shy, you don't want to interact with us on the air, then just keep sending your questions to us at radioprogram@aol.com and omit your phone number. Layla and I will endeavor to answer those questions. But if you're desirous of having a conversation with me live on the radio, include your phone number and we will call you and put you on the air. The reason is because our program is live, but for our WR listening audience, those of you who follow us on weekends on WR, for a short period of time, we are moving to a different time. The reason is the Mets are playing spring training. Apparently, they don't have lights in the Grapefruit League, so they have no night games. They have all day games down in Florida.
This is also the month of March, right?
It's the month of March and part of the month of April. I think there may be a couple of basketball games involved as well. But we're temporarily moving to a new slot. Sunday nights from 11 p.m. to 12 midnight. But the show will be broadcast live from 12 noon on Saturdays to 2 p.m. Yeah, it's a little complicated. The national audience is going to hear it from noon to 2 p.m. The WR audience is going to hear just 1 hour from 11 to 12 midnight. And so you want to listen to it live? Fine. Go, you know, stay up late on Sunday night. Most people are a little bit jet-lagged on Sunday, so they, you know, go to sleep a little later. Listen from 11 to midnight. Same program. It just had been pre-recorded on Saturday. And we'll be back soon to our regular time slot on Saturdays from 1 to 2 p.m. That all sounds very complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah, they'll figure it out. We've been sending postcards about all that information about the radio show on Saturday.
You know what's weird is that some of the people who are going to start listening to us on Sunday nights are the self-same people who used to listen to me at that same time slot, but weeknights. For many years, I was on weeknights from 11 p.m. to midnight, and people used to say, this is weird. I don't know if this ever happened to you, and when you meet a person for the first time, and the person says, oh, I fall asleep with you every night. That's a weird thing to hear from a stranger. But what happens is people would turn on the radio and then to the soothing, dulcet sounds of my voice. I guess they didn't maybe care so much about the content. They just said, you know, it sounds good. It would just lull them to sleep. So we're the same, you know, it'll be like a homecoming for those people who used to listen to me late weeknights on WOR. From 11 to midnight, we have a Sunday night show once again, but only for a short time. All right.
Yeah. So, and plus, everybody can still podcast from WOR, right? Your show.
Oh yeah,
your weekend show.
That's the other thing. Is okay. So say you can't, you know, you're completely lose track of it. You're busy. You're not listening on Sundays. Monday mornings, we always put up the podcasts at drhoffman.com. And along with our other great podcasts, like the very one you're listening to. If you're listening to this podcast, you know how to get podcasts. I'm not even going to give you the how-to on that. You found us, so you know how. All right. Thanks very much for joining us once again, Layla.
Thank you so much.
I'll be seeing you in the office in just a little while. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or, alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine. And she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.